I'm pretty okay. So let's start at the beginning. This week's portion is called Lech Lecha. In Lech Lecha, we're introduced to probably the most important or impactful individual in the history of the world, and that person's name is Abraham. When I say the most impactful person, just think about it. Here's a man that in his lifetime, when he discovers monotheism, he's the only person on this planet that believes in one God. And within a mere couple of thousand years, we've gotten to the point where there are not hundreds of millions, but billions of followers who believe in what Abraham discovers. So I'm saying that that's why if you want to think about or talk about who the most impactful people who ever lived, you can certainly make an argument for Abraham. You disagree with me, that's fine, but you can take that outside after class and continue that argument. Now, what's interesting, in order to really see this, you need to have looked at this week's portion and to have looked at last week's portion. Last week's portion we're introduced to somebody named Noah. At the very beginning, it tells us, these are the generations of Noah. Eilu todos Noah. Noah ish tzaddik. So the first thing we're told about him is that Noah is a righteous person. Es ha'elokim his halech Noah. Sorry. Eilu todos Noah. Noah ish tzaddik. Tamim haya bidorosav. He was perfect in his generation. Ve'es ha'elokim his halech Noah. And he walked with God. So we're told three things about Noah right away, which tell us why Noah is chosen. We're told that Noah was a righteous man. We're told he's perfect in his generation, and we're told that he walks with God. When it comes to Abraham, and you keep that description in mind, it comes to Abraham. The portion begins very differently. I mean, the difference is stark. It says, "And God said to Abraham, pick up and go, leave your land, leave your birthplace, leave your father's home, and you go to land which I've told you." Now, if it were only that one verse where he's given a mission, okay, if you choose to accept it, this is what you do, then fine. But then it continues to say, I'm going to make you into a great nation. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make your name great. You will be a point of blessing. Whoever you bless will be blessed. Whoever you curse will be cursed, which means he's getting all kinds of divine blessings over here, and we don't have any kind of indication as to why he may have been deserving for all of this which takes place. That's my question. Now, every week we read through the portion, the Torah portion, and afterwards, at the very end, we read a part of the prophets, which is called the Haftorah. And if you read through the whole Haftorah, it apparently has nothing to do with the portion. I mean, you can read it. I mean, at face value, it has nothing to do except for one sentence. If you work harder, it may have a lot more to do with it, but as I said, at face value, it has nothing to do with it. There's only one thing which immediately comes to mind. It says, "You, my nation, Vata Yisrael, Avdi Yaakov, Asher Bacharticha, you Israel, my servant Jacob, who I've chosen, Zera Avraham Ohavi, you are the descendants of Abraham who loves me." So over here it tells us something, and he's the only person in the Bible who's described in this way. We're told something about Abraham. What is it? We're told that he loves God. He is a lover of God. What that means, or at which juncture in his life he loves God, or what is it in his life that he did that indicated that he loved God, or how the love of God manifested itself, all of that is lacking. And for that, we need to work a little bit harder and to find out, what is it about Abraham? Or what is it about Abraham's capacity for love? Or what is it about Abraham's love of God, which causes him to be called this? And for that matter, at this point, for lack of any other understanding, what causes him to be chosen? So some of the commentators pick or identify an episode which is not actually written in the Torah itself. There is an episode which is recorded by tradition that tells us that Abraham was a man who discovers God. And by the way, it's interesting because it doesn't seem to be that he discovered God all at once, that he had an epiphany. rather seems to be a process that he goes through. There are some sources that say at the age of 3 he understood that there was a God. Well, it wasn't until the age of 48 that he was able to really intellectualize it properly. It wasn't until the age of 52 that he starts to teach other people. And this conversation between God and Abraham takes place at the age of 75. There may be biblical evidence to one earlier conversation that took place at the age of 70. But by the way, that itself to me is fascinating, that Abraham may have understood that there was a God at the age of 3, had a sophisticated understanding of it by the age of 48, was willing to die for it by the age of 48, but doesn't get affirmation till the age of 70 or 75. That's many years of loneliness. That's many years where a person can be filled with self-doubt. At the age of 48, something significant happened. If you're interested in world history at that point, the people were busy, as we saw at the end of last week's portion, building a tower up into heaven. According to the description, the way they were making the bricks, they had furnaces about in order to, I don't know what the proper word is, if it's smelt or if that's only for precious metals. They were making the bricks in the ovens and the furnaces. At that point, they may have recognized that there was a thing called God, but they were certainly did not accept that God because they were going to war against that God. The whole concept of building a tower up towards the heavens seemed to have been an idea that one can attack the God. And at the base of this, there may have been some kind of a tradition about that God had once sent a flood, so what's the best way to protect yourself from the next flood is to build a tower up because just in case the water doesn't come. But it seems to be that man does not recognize God as an all-powerful monotheistic deity, quite the opposite. If they believed that God was this all-powerful monotheistic deity, it's very unlikely they would have felt that they would have had the ability of building a tower and going to war and making a name for themselves and having another conquest against this God. The person who led the way was a man named Nimrod. Nimrod was a man who knew of power. He's the man who lived and died by the sword. He's a man who believed that just as he had other conquests, this can be his ultimate conquest to defeat this God. Abraham at that point challenges all of his contemporaries. And by the way, some of the logic that he uses, again, according to the rabbinic tradition, is wonderful. Some of it is quite contemporary. And maybe it's worthwhile, at least for us, to touch it for a second. We're told that his father was an idolater and his father owned an idol store. And his father goes out for work, comes back in, and in the meantime, Abraham had taken a hammer and broken all the idols except for one. So his father comes in and sees all the broken idols. So what does his father say when he comes in? No. He says, "Oh, my gods." Okay, I'm kidding. He comes in and says, "What happened?" So Abraham says it was unbelievable. They started pushing, they started fighting. One guy says, "I'm the man." The other one says, "No, I'm the man." And they start going back and forth. "Don't you talk to me like that." And they push and they fight. And they get into this whole big fight. And then the big guy takes a hammer and starts smashing all the little idols. And he goes on and tells this whole tale. And his father says, "What in the world are you talking about? They're inanimate objects. They can't do this." And Abraham said, "You know, I suspected the same thing." And the words of the rabbis is, "Do your ears hear what your mouth is saying?" If you understand cognitively that these are inanimate objects, then how in the world can you worship them? We're told along the way that a woman comes in and he says, "You know, how old are you?" Or a man comes in, "How old are you?" And the guy says, and he says, "Why would you want to worship an idol which was made yesterday? How can all of your hopes and aspirations and dreams be fulfilled by something which is inanimate and made yesterday? This is an absurdity." So the logic that Abraham is using, as I said, is quite good. At that point, we're told that this Nimrod, who is very unsympathetic to this rebellion taking place, summons Abram and says, "Come, Abram, let's worship fire together." And Abram says, "I'd be happy to worship the fire, except shouldn't we worship water? Because water can extinguish fire." So Nimrod says, "Fine, let's worship the water." He goes, "You know, come to think of it, instead of worshiping water, we should worship the clouds, because water comes from the clouds." So he says, fine, let's worship the clouds. He goes, well, if that's the case, maybe we shouldn't worship the clouds. We should worship the wind because the wind can move the clouds. He says, let's worship the wind. And you get the sense that this could be a non-ending dialogue. And at some point, Nimrod gets very frustrated and says, you know what, let's just go back to the fire. And at that point, they throw him into the furnace. But those furnaces that exist are connected thematically with the furnace which exists when they were building the tower to go up into heaven. Which means part of the background is this rebellion against God, which Nimrod is leading the way. And of course, what does the name Nimrod mean? It means the one who rebels. So Nimrod is the one who's rebelling against God. Abraham rebels against Nimrod. Abraham is the breaker of idols. You know how to say that in fancy English? He's an iconoclast. An iconoclast literally means a breaker of idols. But in Abraham's sense, it's an iconoclast in every sense of the word, because it means that Abraham is somebody who's breaking what everyone else believes in, and he's rebelling against the rebeller. He's rebelling against Nimrod, who had rebelled against God, and Abraham at that point most likely had the most lonely existence. But according to the rabbis, especially the Ramban, there was one thing that he did have at that point, an absolutely incredible, firm, strong, passionate love of God. And it's that is why he's called Abraham that loves me. By the way, the Ramban in another context tells us, again, it's interesting, Abraham is chosen because of his love of God, and he tells us, and his love of God is manifested, according to this, in his ability or his willingness to even give up his life for that belief. The Ramban tells us the entire Jewish people are chosen. And by the way, this is a very sensitive point. What makes us the chosen people? Are we smarter? Are we better looking? Are we better athletes? Sometimes. Sometimes is the answer. So the Ramban says that as a people we're stubborn, which sometimes we're attacked for, but we have a willingness to live for a principle and sometimes die for a principle more than other people do. Again, I can't judge this, you know, as I said before, empirically. But it's interesting because right away you can say, hold it, look, what are the suicide bombers? They're willing to die for an idea, but it's very different. The suicide bombers, unfortunately, hate us so much they're willing to kill themselves in order to hate us. We're told that this was already behavior that was found in the desert when Amalek attacked us for the first time. Amalek was this nation that could not stand the Jewish people, and so they were willing to jump into a boiling hot furnace, or water, or bath, as it were, in order just to take us down with them. What the Ramban is saying about the Jews is that we are willing not to go and kill someone else for our ideal, but we're willing to stay with our beliefs no matter how much pain we're put under. And if we would not be a stubborn people, it's very hard to believe that we'd still be around today. So as I said, the Ramban's concept over here is that love manifests itself in one's ability to self-sacrifice. Okay, that may not have been the initial concept of love that most of you would have thought of when I said, what does it mean to love? But that's the way that the Ramban understands the idea of love. If I'll go back to the arguments for a moment that Abraham uses, there's another rabbinic tradition that tells us that he sees a house, and he sees a house on fire, and he starts to think, no, how did that happen? Things don't happen by themselves. And he starts thinking, well, if there's a house, there must have been an architect, there must have been a builder, there must have been all kinds of things which are used in order to build a house, because things just don't happen by themselves. And it was at that point that we're told that God finally introduces himself, which means first Abraham understands that just like a house needs a builder, an architect, and a plan, so too does the world. And therefore he comes to this logical conclusion. Now the truth is, again, these arguments are not immature. They don't lack sophistication. And they're still things which are based upon observation, which are worthwhile thinking about today. You know, let me just throw something out at you. This is just to bother you, and you can think about it if you want. You can debate it later. But you can't tell me I'm wrong. Unless you have to. If you have to, you will. Evolution, is it a theory or a law?
Theory.
You sure? Not because Dr. Schroeder said it. Is evolution a theory or a law?
Theory.
It's a theory. Second principle of thermodynamics. Is it a law or is it a theory?
It's a law.
It's a law. What does evolution say? That as time goes on, things will evolve and eventually improve. What is the second principle of thermodynamics? that things, as they go on, tend to deteriorate. Not tend, things deteriorate. Things move towards entropy. Things move towards disorder. Your mother comes to your room and says, what happened to your room? What do you say? Second principle of thermodynamics. Things left by themselves tend to deteriorate, right? Again, is that a law of physics or is that a principle? Or is that a theory? It's a principle, it's a law. Which means when you look at something which is sophisticated, you would tend to believe that there must be something that did it. You go into a forest and you see a tree which is flat, has four legs which are each perfectly symmetrical, and they look like a very skilled person carved them. Would you say, well, that tree developed that way, or would you more likely say, well, somebody came and carved it and made a table? Which means the more sophisticated something is, the less likely you would think it happened by itself. That kind of argument is based upon observation. I don't know who first made it up and calls this the second principle of thermodynamics. That doesn't make a difference. It's based on observation of nature. And what the rabbis put in Abraham's mouth are those kinds of arguments based upon observation, based on the understanding that things just don't happen by themselves, that things must have, something must have formed them. Again, I'm not going to talk about evolution. You can take that outside afterwards. You can argue about it. Evolution is fascinating. It's fascinating how you have so many people absolutely accepting something which at face value does go against observable scientific fact. I'm saying just think about that for a moment. What evolution does for us is it provides us with another scenario to how we got to where we are today, a scenario which can theoretically take God out of the equation. And by the way, I'll say one more thing about this. If you want to argue with me, you can. But I'll say one more thing about it. Thinking is a very interesting process. Sometimes you get messed up because your starting point is wrong. And I'll explain to you exactly what I mean. If you start today and work backwards and say, how did we get here? Evolution becomes a very compelling argument. Because you look backwards, you say, well, we're here and we must have come from this and this must have come from this and this must have come from this and so on and so forth. So when you work backwards, it's a very compelling argument. What happens, on the other hand, if you work forwards? Which means when you try to do some of the mathematical analysis of what are the odds of random mutation going from point A to point B, you'll end up with the type of numbers which are astronomic. Then you go from point B to point C, you'll end up with numbers that are astronomic. Point B, point C to D and E to F and so on. If you were to hit a jackpot, one out of a million. Years ago, I remember there was a lottery in New York, and they said that there were 1 in 3.5 million chance to win. Right? The numbers over here are much larger than that. If you hit the jackpot 4, 5, 6 times in a row, the same person wins it, what would you say? That there's a fix. There's a fix on it. Which means that's the difference between looking backwards versus looking forwards. If you go forwards and say, okay, there's a 1 in a billion chance that this is going to go in this direction, and you hit that, okay, you can always get to 1 in a billion. But when you get a series of 1 in a billions in a row, then you start to get uncomfortable intellectually. As I said, you go backwards. Where did we come from? We must have come from here, from here, from here, from here. It becomes very compelling. You go forwards with the same argument. You say, that's ridiculous. But and by the way, I'll tell you a secret. I don't care if evolution is true or not. It makes no difference to me. I'm just thinking out loud right now. I think it's incredibly unlikely that evolution could have happened without some kind of divine finger. You know, like the Michelangelo with the finger down there? But you need that finger at various stages in order to gently push things to go one or the other. Which means it makes no difference to me in terms of my own belief system whether there could or were various stages of an evolutionary process as long as I don't take God out of the picture. Which means I think that what people often do with evolution is that they use it as an alternative scenario to a biblical story. But people also tend to be very silly, right? You've noticed this? People tend to either be biblical literalists, let's take every word of the Bible at face value, or they tend to be scientific literalists. I think all of us realize that the truth can be someplace in between. Especially when it comes to Jewish tradition, which tells us on virtually every single verse of the Torah not to take it at face value, that everything is at a deeper level and nothing should be analyzed or accepted exactly as it says it, which is why we have to work a lot harder right now. So let's go back to Abraham, who loves God. Now, I stopped earlier, one verse short, of what could have provided us with some kind of textual explanation for why Abraham was chosen. It says God said all these things to him, said, pick up and go, and I'm going to give you this blessing, I'm going to make you a source of blessing, and so on and so forth. And then it says that Abraham went, he took his wife, he took his nephew, and then it says, V'chol ha-nefesh esher asu b'choran. And he took all of the people that they made. Now, most of you know that making people is not easy. What does this verse mean? All the people that they made while they were in Haran. There were three possibilities to it. One is that Abraham knew how to make people, which, by the way, Kabbalistic interpretations don't mind that at all. There's a mystical book called the Sefer Yetzirah, Book of Creation. Ever hear of the legend of the golem? So the Sefer Yetzirah is how you make a golem. It says that, according to tradition, it goes all the way back to Abraham. Abraham understood God. He understood how to create, and Abraham created people. If that makes you happy, you don't have to go any further. That's one possibility. But as I said, that's an obscure mystical tradition. Second possibility is acquisitions. Even though he acquired slaves and servants and so on, even though the word acquisition over here would be a better word than made, it should have said, and all the people that he acquired, not all the people that he made. And again, it's they made. The term is v'chol ha-nefesh asher asu. So the third possibility is students. And that possibility would then indicate that Abraham starts to teach. Now, by the way, this already matches within certain traditions which are passed down to us again from the Talmud. The Talmud tells us, bless you, the Talmud tells us that there were 2,000 years of nothingness, 2,000 years of Torah, and 2,000 years of the Messiah. You guys have a sense of Jewish history? What year is Abraham born in terms of Jewish history? From the beginning? Good. Abraham's born in 1948. The Talmud says that Abraham starts to teach people when he was 52 years old. What year would that make it? 2,000. Which means 2,000 years the world exists devoid of Torah. In the year 2000, Torah begins to be taught for the first time. By the way, if Abraham is 52 and if he's 48 years old at the time of the tower when he was thrown into the furnace and then saved miraculously by a divine miracle, that means that Abraham starts to conceive an idea of God by the age of 3. He works on this concept till the age of 48, where he's persecuted for his beliefs and they try to kill him for his beliefs. And by the age of 52, he has become at this point empowered by his success, and he starts to teach other people. And that would be the year 2000. If, whereas we're told over here he's 75, by the time God speaks to him and tells him to pick up and go, that means that between the age of 52 and 75, Abraham starts to teach, to collect all kinds of followers, and finally when he makes his way to Israel, he makes his way together with a whole band of people. The Rambam, Maimonides, based upon a passage in a book called the Sifri, which is an ancient rabbinic book, tells us that love of God, and Jews are commanded to love God. When we say the Shema every day, we say at first, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, here is the Lord of God, the Lord is one. And then we say right afterwards, V'yahavta et Hashem Elokecha, you should love God with all your heart, all your soul, all your possessions. What does it mean to love God? And that's intriguing. What does it mean to love? Okay. If a guy sees a girl walking down the street, and she looks attractive in a certain type of way, and he says, I'm in love. Is that love?
Lust.
Is that why would you say it's not love? Okay, you called it something else, but why would you say it's not love? Why?
He doesn't know
her. He doesn't know her. You can't love someone until you know them. So therefore, what you've just now established, in order to be able to love God, what do you have to do? You have to know God, which means you have to study about God. You have to understand God. Now, that's going to be very difficult because all of us are limited. It's also difficult because we're then going to create a tension. If you know God, is the first thing that's going to come out, is that going to be love or is that going to be fear or awe? Which means there's going to be a difficulty over here. And this whole interaction between love and fear or love and awe is something which we need to get back to. But But that is something which I think is interesting. But obviously, as you know, you're correct. If a guy sees a girl and says, I'm in love, he's not in love, it's not love, it's something else. But you can't love someone unless you know them, and the more you know about them, the deeper the love then can be. And therefore, the first part of the mitzvah, the commandment of loving God, means that to study God, to understand the Torah, to understand the commandments, and only then can you possibly fulfill this commandment of loving God. But then the Rambam, Maimonides, throws off a second issue about loving God. He says, if you love God, you would tell people about it. You wouldn't keep it to yourself. Come on. If you found something which was the greatest thing in the world, would you want to keep it all for yourself, or would you want to give it or share it? Hopefully. But by the way, I want you to think about this. The greatest natural resource on this planet is love. Because every other resource, as you use it, it disappears. Love, the more you use it, the more it grows. But if you think about it, we live in such a sad, frightened generation that we're afraid to love. We're afraid to share it. We're afraid to give it. We're afraid to tell people how we feel. Because we feel inadequate and we feel so frightened at times. We feel very vulnerable. Come on, we live in a generation that people would quicker take off their clothes and show their body than they would to share their soul and show their soul, bear their soul. No, it's an incredibly sad statement about our generation, about how we live. But it's because of a fear. And again, just think about it. Love is there to be shared, and we're afraid to do it. Abraham is somebody who understands love, and all that he wants to do is share it. All that he wants to do is teach people about it. That's part of loving God, which means he understands, and it's more than that. Let's think this through a little bit deeper now. If you live in a polytheistic world, right? You all know what I mean by polytheistic? You live in a world with many gods. Essentially, you have a bureaucracy. There's nobody in charge, and you have each god or demigod in charge of their particular area. So what do you do if you want something? You got to pay off that god. You cut a deal. Make a deal, pay it off, and now you get something in exchange. That's because each one of these gods, by definition, because there are many of them, each one of these gods is limited. If each one of these gods is limited, then each one of these gods has needs. Why do they have needs? Because they're limited. Yes? If you then believe that there's only one all-powerful, unlimited God, when that becomes the conclusion, doesn't need anything. But by the way, this is so important, what I just now said. I'm not saying that because I said it. It's so important that once you internalize this concept, you can finally have real religious growth. Because the whole time that you think you can do a good deed and you make God's day, I'll say a blessing on food and God is up there high-fiving all the angels, you can't make God's day. You can't do anything for God. It just doesn't work. If you believe that there's one all-powerful God, you cannot do anything for God. What can you do? You can try to emulate God. You can try to be like God. You could try to be godly in your relationships. Abraham has a breakthrough in terms of his own religious growth and his religious identity when he gets to this point that he understands there is no such thing as polytheism. All of these gods that his people in his neighborhood are worshiping are meaningless. These gods were made by man. Instead of looking at man who's in the image of God, they created gods in the image of men. And any of you who've studied Greek mythology will understand exactly what I said. And not only are they in the image of men, generally the lowest common denominator of men. Abraham has this breakthrough that there's one, because there's this one God that creates everything. The more complicated the thing is, there must be something here that created it all. And then he comes to this understanding that if there's one all-powerful God, that God has no needs. Hold it. If God has no needs, then why does God create? And if you guys, if anybody here is from New York, you can't understand this. It's because of a word called altruism. which means that God does good for the sake of doing good, not with any ulterior motives. Again, I grew up in New York. If someone's nice to you, you get real scared. Come on, the most frightening thing that can happen, you're taking a subway, somebody smiles at you. No? It's scary. If you're walking the street of New York and somebody says, "Here, let me take that bag for you. Let me give you a hand." Again, if you're not from New York, you're from Iowa, you say, "Wow, they're so nice in New York, and I'm sure I'm going to get my bag back soon." You want to know how the story ends, or that's enough? That's what I'm saying. Again, we're jaded. We're jaded. We don't even think about love. We don't think about being nice. We don't think about these things because we've been emotionally destroyed. But Abraham, on the other hand, he understands that there's one all-powerful God. And if there is, in fact, one all-powerful God, then by definition, you can do nothing for that God. By definition, that God needs nothing. And by definition, that God creates not out of any lack or any need, rather that God creates out of absolute, unconditional love. Chesed. Kindness. Desire to give. So what does Abraham then do? He does something which is the most difficult thing that there is. What is that? He recreates himself. I'm not going to say that he hired a PR firm and says, "Okay, give me a new image," right? Or go shopping, right? He gets a makeover. That's not what he does. When I said he recreates himself, not from the outside in, but he recreates himself from the inside out. And he says, if God creates out of an act of love, then I need to be godly. I need to be like God. I need to spread this love around, and I need to be kind to people. That's revolutionary. Do you realize how revolutionary this is within the context of the ancient world? The ancient world which teaches us that might makes right. The pagan world which only respected power, violence. And Abraham comes out and says, there's something which is on a higher level than violence. There's a higher level than power. And what is that? That's love. I'm saying that's a revolutionary concept. And Abraham then becomes, and don't misunderstand this, the greatest lover who ever existed. See, you're all corrupted, so you hear me say that. You're thinking about other things. You're thinking in other directions. But Abraham becomes a man who is so consumed with love of God and love of man because he sees within every single person the image of God. Because he realized that God created every single person. And by seeing the image of God of every single person, he sees godliness all over. Not pantheism, not that everything is God. He sees godliness within everything. And all that he wants to do is try to connect people back with God who created them. And Abraham then becomes absolutely this man on a mission trying to connect people. We're told, and this it does say in the Torah, it says that he planted something called Eshel. And then he called out in the name of God. And we don't know what this Eshel is. We don't know what it means to call out in the name of God. And it sounds like a non sequitur. The commentaries tell us that what does it mean he planted? There's two different opinions. One, he planted an orchard. One is that he built. The location, what we're told this happened, is a place called Beersheba. We're told that he built an inn or a tent. He pitches his tent in Beersheba. You guys know where Beersheba is geographically? It's towards the south of Israel, facing the desert, which means travelers would come in from the south, travelers would come through the desert, and what would be awaiting them when they get to the other side of the desert? Abraham's tent. And what would he do? He'd say, "Come in, rest, take some water, take some food, you need a shower, you need whatever you need." And he would sit them down, give them a meal, and they would say, "Abraham, thank you, you're the nicest man we've ever met." And you know what he would say? "Don't thank me, thank God." You want to eat fruit? Thank God for the fruit that he gave us. Which means Abraham used his kindness as a way of connecting to God. And you understand why this is. Because it's ultimately God's kindness that created Abraham's kindness. Because his kindness is an outgrowth of the kindness that he perceives coming from God. Now, all of this, everything I've said so far, is based upon what I've already told you. One phrase, one turn of phrase, in the Haftorah, in the book of Isaiah, where it says that the Jews were chosen because they're descendants of Abraham who loved me. So we're told that Abraham loved God. But I want to get back to this point about fear. What exactly does it mean to love God? The Rambam, in the 10th chapter of the Laws of Tshuva, the Laws of Return, and it's interesting, in the earlier chapters he talks about how man can sin and needs to fix a sin, how man can sin and needs to fix the relationship with God. When he gets to the 10th chapter, he doesn't talk about sin anymore, and he doesn't talk about repentance anymore, he doesn't talk about Tshuva anymore. Instead, he talks about something else. He talks about serving God. And he says the highest level of serving God, one which is elusive, and it even eludes the grasp of some of the greatest scholars, he says, is to do the right thing because it's the right thing. Not because of any ulterior motive. To do truth because it's truth. And he says, that's the level of Abraham. Abraham's on the level that he embraces truth because it's truth. Now, if you go through Abraham's life, there are all kinds of episodes where we can begin to question, hold it, was that motivated by love or not necessarily? And instead of going through each one, I want to jump fast forward to the most difficult episode of Abraham's life. And that episode is called The Binding of Isaac, Akedas Yitzchak, where God says to Abraham, Abraham, take your son, your only son, the son that you love, take your son and offer him as an offering on one of the mountains. Lift him up as an offering. Now the truth is, we can literally spend all day, all week, and for that matter, all year analyzing this section. There is so much to say about it. There's so many levels of analysis. But I want to stick to one particular point. At the end, when Isaac is tied down to the altar, when the knife is in Abraham's hand and is coming down rapidly towards Isaac's neck, an angel calls out from heaven and says, Abraham, Abraham, stop. And Abraham stops. And the angel says, for now I know that you fear God. And of course we could have asked, shouldn't it have said at this point, for now I know that you love God? And what kind of love would that be? It would have been the kind of love where somebody loves God more than anything else. Remember, love God with all your heart and all your soul, all your possessions. It's easy to say it. It's easy to say it two or three times a day. But to really, really do it, to internalize that, to say that I really love God more than all my possessions, that's difficult. To say that I love God more than my life, that's very difficult. To say I love God more than my son's life. I mean, just think about this test. He's been praying for a child for all of his adult life. He finally has this child. And God says, okay, let's see how this goes. Let's see who you love more. Do you love me or your son more? Come on. That's the kind of test that none of us would ever want to imagine, even in our worst nightmares. Who do you love more? So I could have claimed that this test is to test Abraham's love. But as I said, it's not what it says at the end. It says, for now I know that you fear me. Again, the word ki yirei Elokim ata, that you are somebody who fears God. Now, if the Torah calls Avraham a God-fearer, or yirei Elokim, then why have been spending the last half an hour, 35 minutes, trying to insist that what Abraham really is a man of love? So apparently there's a tension. And as I said, there's many ways of understanding that and many things to say about it. I mean, one thing that I could say, let's go start from the beginning again. Let's theorize that Abraham himself is a very kind man. He's a nice man. He's kinder and gentler than all the other people of his generation. And he comes and tells them all, don't sacrifice and you don't need to do things and God doesn't need anything from you, God just wants your good deeds. But maybe Abraham would be open to the attack that he also created God in his image the same way that all the idolaters did, but he just created a nicer God. But it's nonetheless, it's a man-made God. And perhaps, therefore, it would be necessary for this God to tell Abraham to do something which is different from what Abraham would want to do, different from what Abraham would like to do. And therefore, he asks Abraham to do the exact opposite of what comes easy to him. Again, real growth, how can I put this? I think there's two stages towards religious growth. The first stage is using your capabilities in terms of serving God. The second stage of growth is creating new capabilities in the serving of God. The first stage is very important. The second stage is transcendent. Because the first stage, you go in deep inside of yourself and you know yourself and you look at yourself and say, okay, now I'm going to use what I have and serve God. The second stage is you find something in you that you never knew was there. That's a much more difficult point. That's the point that Abraham eventually needs to get to, and maybe that's the understanding over here. Maybe that's why Abraham needs to go through such a difficult thing. And again, let's keep in mind, ultimately, God says to Abraham, I don't want you to sacrifice him. Ultimately, he tells him to stop. Ultimately, he gives a message to all of mankind throughout history. I don't want human sacrifice. I don't need human sacrifice. This is not something which is acceptable. You've already gone far enough. And maybe there's even another thought to this, that even the thought process of the willingness is as if you've actually done it. By the way, when we say Shema every day, Hear, O Israel, Lord is God, Lord is one, love God with all your heart and all your soul, what you should mentally image at that moment is that if push comes to shove, I'd be prepared to give my life up to God. And that's enough. You've just now fulfilled the commandment as if you were being, you know, tortured to death, as if you died in the Holocaust, as if you died defending the land or the people of Israel. And you don't have to go that far, but just the preparedness to do it is the fulfillment of a positive commandment. And by the way, if you're really able to visually image that, at that moment, you get incredibly close to God. Because at that moment, you've just pushed everything else aside, all these unimportant things that occupy us. You know, it's interesting. People sometimes say that they have a hard time focusing on prayer. You go through a thought process like that, you're going to have no problem focusing. You create this kind of mental image. You're able to visualize to which point you really believe in God, to the point of giving up one's life. At that moment, you have no difficulty. You will have no difficulty whatsoever in praying with focus, with kavanah, because you've just made it as real as possible. And at the same time, it's absolutely legitimate to pray to God, but never test me and don't put me in this situation, but this is what I'm prepared to do. We don't want to be tested. We don't want to be tested at all. And ultimately, the message of the Akedah, the message of the binding of Isaac, is God saying, I don't want to test you either, which means I don't want to go that far. I don't want to go to the point where Isaac is actually killed. The intention, the preparedness of doing something is enough. You don't have to go to the next stage. But still, I'm left with the problem. I'm left with this voice, this angelic voice that comes down out of heaven, this epiphany that Abraham has. The angel comes and says, now I know that you fear God. Right? Now I know that you're Rei Elohim Ata. So the mystical commentaries tell us the following. There's a thing which is called love of God. There's a thing which is called fear of God. The issue, though, is there's two different types of fear of God, and for the sake of clarity, I want to use the Hebrew word right now. The Hebrew word is called Yirei Elohim. The phrase is Yirei Elohim, fear God. Now, the word Yirei, depending how it's translated in context, could mean anything from fear, I'm afraid of. It could also mean awe, I'm in awe of. The problem is that the language now is going to be somewhat difficult for us, so let me instead give examples. These commentaries tell us there's two levels of Yirei Elohim, to be afraid of God. And I'll stay with the word afraid. One level is that you're afraid if you do something wrong, God will punish you. So why do you do the right thing? Because you're afraid of the consequences of doing the wrong thing. By the way, is that a high level? What if you were told that there's no consequences? Would you do the wrong thing? Which is, it's not that the wrong thing bothers you. It's just that you don't want the consequences. That's one level. According to these commentaries, that is beneath the concept of love. You have that kind of fear of God because you're afraid he's going to punish you. And by the way, I shall tell you a secret. That's the level that almost every single human being lives on. Very few people are able to take it to the next level. What's the next level? The next level is that you love God and you want to do the right things because it's the right things. To do the right thing because it's the right thing. That's the next level. It's hard for us to live on that level. But there's a higher level. The higher level is another level of fear, of yira. And that is, I don't want to do the wrong thing because I love God so much and I would not want to disappoint God. Let's take God out of the picture for a second. You could not cheat on your wife because you're afraid she's going to kill you. You can not cheat on your wife because you love your wife. You cannot cheat on your wife because the thought of cheating your wife would never occur to you, because the last thing you want to do in this life is anything in any way that would possibly hurt her feelings and make her feel bad. Which means that the fear of even hurting her feelings, and it's fear, you don't want to hurt her feelings, is a manifestation of love. You have fear by itself, you have love, and then you have a fear which is an outgrowth of love. That's the level that Abraham achieves. Which means, according to this approach, Abraham has such love for God that he doesn't want to possibly do something which can disappoint God. And the truth is, he's in an incredible moral quandary when he's asked to offer his son. Why is he willing to do it? He's willing to do it because he does not want to hurt God at any level. Does he love his son? Absolutely. Does he love God? Absolutely. But at this point, when he's told to do this, he clarifies that he would not want to do anything in this life which can possibly lead to a moment of God's disappointment or distancing between man and God. That's the level that Abraham achieves. Where are we left with all this? First of all, we should take pride in knowing there was a man named Abraham. When we pray, we say, blessed is God, the God of Abraham. We should focus on that for a moment. We should focus on this concept of love. We should focus on the concept of giving. We should understand how Abraham understood that polytheism is bankrupt theologically. It's bankrupt morally. We should approach the world as Abraham approaches the world. We should try to get out of ourselves and try to give and help others. We should try to find the godliness within ourselves and the godliness within others. We have to realize that love is, as I said before, the greatest possible resource, and the more that we use it, instead of afterwards feeling wasted, instead of afterwards feeling rejected or jaded or used, that when we actually really use love, what happens is that it grows, and it can grow exponentially. And we live in a world which is so far from that. We live in a world which is so afraid of this. And the level of fear which exists in this world is not even the lower level of fear which I discussed earlier. It could be that we should also appreciate that Abraham wasn't born in a day, that there's a process within his own development. And we don't have to therefore think of ourselves that if we haven't reached the highest level of enlightenment in our first 2 weeks in yeshiva, so that means it's not going to happen. That if it takes Abraham from the age of 3 to 48 to be able to clarify the concept, and from 48 to 52 to be able to speak about the concept, and at the age of 52 till 70 or 75, when finally God comes and gives him confirmation. Again, just imagine how long that was, playing with this idea before that moment when God finally says, Abraham, you were right, here I am. We all hope that one day we'll get to revelation. We hope that at one point we'll get to enlightenment, that we'll get to understanding. But we have to realize that the first step of that is fear of God, and the second step of that is love of God, and the third step of getting there is getting to the love of God, which is married together with the fear of God, is loving God to the extent that we wouldn't possibly want to disappoint. If we develop that ability within ourselves to have this kind of relationship with God, I can absolutely assure you that relationships that we have with other people as well, that we have with our friends, that we have with our neighbors, that we have with our spouses, that we have with our children, will be absolutely incredible relationships, because we would have then developed ourselves into being enlightened individuals, And hopefully that kind of enlightenment will spread. Have a good Shabbos.